Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 549, and it's the first guest of the year. Thank you for all the love for the first episode of the year, which is always the Films of the Year episode that got a lot of love from you guys. Had a few people ask if I'm going to do a TV Shows of the Year episode, because last year I did that with John and Joel from Dream Factory podcast, and I've just got so many guests lined up at the moment that I wasn't able to fit it in. But if I can nail those two guys down, I might do one kind of end of Jan, beginning of Feb, mid-Feb, end of Feb, sometime in the first quarter. How's that for professional language? But we're here for the first guest of the year, and it's an amazing one. It's Joel Edgerton. Huge name. I'm a huge fan of Joel. Had Joel on the podcast before, and it's one of the classic episodes. And I had the opportunity to have Joel in on again. And they gave me 90 minutes, which is mad. Like, press junkets. I'm always pushing for 90 minutes, particularly if it's someone I'm excited about. But yeah, they gave me 90 minutes and we just had a hell of a conversation. As I said, I've had Joel on before. It was a certain amount of time ago. I'm not going to go into too much detail because there's a bit at the start. It's what I lead with. It's going to blow your minds. It blew our minds. But it was a certain amount of time ago. And I wasn't sure if he'd remember or anything. And he did. And it was lovely. And we had a wonderful chat. I definitely was sitting there thinking, we get on really well. We should definitely work together in a film at some point with Barry Keoghan. It's weird. It'll make sense when you listen. But I definitely think down the line, me, Joel and Barry should work on a film together. So if anyone involved is listening, hit me up. But yeah, it's a wonderful chat. We went like 45 minutes before we even got into talking about films, really. It's a joy. But we're brought to you as ever by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. That's where you can buy all your merch. If you've got some Christmas money that you want to spend, come on over and spend it. Also, you can support the podcast by going to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip and head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio if you want to just come and hang out and watch me chat, sometimes play games. I did a really fun stream over Christmas. It was essentially a drunk cast on Twitch. Thank you for all the love for the drunk cast, by the way. It was essentially a drunk cast on Twitch. It was me, B Dolan, 1030, Ad, Cudder, and Llama Chan. And they're just all streamers and humans that I absolutely adore. So we just spent like 5 hours, maybe 6 hours drinking and hanging out. We played No More Jockeys. We played 20 Questions. It was great fun. And that's all on there to go and watch for free if you want as well. But there's all sorts of fun stuff like that. Me and B Dolan have started doing a thing called Pip and B Show Each Other Stuff. And it's a semi-regular thing. The first episode was musical performances on TV shows, on late night TV, and that's all over there to watch. We picked our favourites. Go and have a look, twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio. I'm rambling now, and I've forgotten that this is a nice long episode to kick the year off, so let's get into it. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 549, with Joel Edgerton. And we're recording. I'm here with Joel Edgerton. How are you, man?
I'm really good, thank you.
You came on this podcast, and the weird part is it was 5 years ago today.
Oh, really?
That we recorded in this same hotel.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you coming over to celebrate our 5-year anniversary. And really, it's really nice of you to plan.
It was like to the day.
To the day, 5 years ago. And I think this is going to sound really insane. I think in this room, because when they sent through, the only reason I know that, I'm not a psychopath, I swear.
Yeah.
The only reason I know that is you know, when you're putting things into a calendar, if you type stuff, it recommends something if it's been before.
Yeah.
And it said, Joel, it was like at 4 o'clock or something in the afternoon, but it was the same hotel and the same room.
Wow.
And you know, that's weird.
Weird tricks on your Apple iPhone too that pull up photos from the exact day from certain years.
Yeah.
How funny.
It's mad, isn't it? So, I mean, how have you been?
Pretty good, man. A lot's changed, that's for sure. Mostly, I've become a dad.
Yeah, how's that?
Amazing. I mean, I wouldn't say anything else, even if it was a lie.
You know, that's the thing.
Kids are like, I listened to that podcast, the second one you did with that dude, and you said it was horrible being a dad. They're like 2.5. I have twins and
twins.
So I'm sure that, you know, whenever they classify, you know, Gen Z, Gen X, Gen, you know, whatever it is, they'll be Gen COVID-19.
Yeah, you know? I was going to say, because we've got a decent amount of time, and obviously I want to talk about the boys in the boat and numerous other things you've done since then. But I want to kind of, I was thinking, let's have a look back over those past 5 years and what jumps out. And the pandemic's going to jump out massively for everyone, but more so if you've had twins in that time. So how was the pandemic? Was that kind of perfectly timed in a way that you know, you probably can't work, you're probably at home with, you know, the family?
Yeah, well, what happened for me was I was at the end of shooting Underground Railroad with Barry Jenkins, and he was one of those lucky people that I think he got shut down 4 days before the end of the shoot, but I had finished all of my shooting and, you know, whispers of the pandemic were starting to sort of surface, and I had gone to Nepal to work, to go and participate in this eye surgery camp with this doctor that I'm involved in through an Australian charity, but it's a Nepalese doctor. Anyway, we were there.
It's the Fred Hollows Foundation,
Fred Hollows,
right?
And his Dr. Ruit, who runs a eye hospital in Kathmandu.
Amazing.
So we'd gone up in the hills. We were shooting a documentary for Australia Story, which I'd agreed to do if they helped focus on the charity, because I was mortified about them prying into my personal life too much. And then I came back through the airport and suddenly there's all these extra people wearing masks. And my partner and I had decided after Barry's shoot that we would go and have a holiday together, and we were going to Turks and Caicos. And I was very excited about that.
Yeah.
And but then that got weird, you know, and we're like, maybe we'd better go somewhere that feels like home.
Yeah.
And we're living in New York. And I'm like, well, I don't want to be in New York when if there's a pandemic, because I just was putting the math together in my head, all the people crossing paths on subways, and like, this is going to be like a Will Smith, like, end of the world movie.
New York isn't the kind of big back garden, plenty of space kind of city.
No.
You're all on top of each other.
And, you know, when things look complicated, it more than ever makes you feel like you want to, like in the musical Chairs of it all, you want to sit in a chair that feels like home, surrounded by people you know. So,
yeah.
We then decided to go back to Australia a week early, and I had a movie that I was producing and going to be in, which we were almost about to go into pre on. Mm-hmm. So I was going back to Australia anyway, but we went a week early, went there, and then we're about to go to Adelaide to shoot this movie, and the world went, for now, no more movies. So we just sat in our house in Bondi, and we're quarantining there, and I started doing yoga every day, and suddenly someone had told me to stop working, because I had become a bit of a workaholic over the last 10 years, because I was like, I love what I do. And I just sort of had a, you know, say with a measure of empathy and my own guilt, I was having an okay time, and I felt very blessed. And then 6 months later, we got to go shoot the movie. So we went to Adelaide, which is a movie called The Stranger.
Yeah.
Which is now on Netflix.
Sean Harris, I want to talk about that a load. I
would love
fantastic.
To talk, yeah.
And I find, I've never met Sean, but I find him so fascinating as just an on-screen presence and, yeah.
Yeah, he and I like sort of became like a weird, you know, odd couple, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, kind of like, because we've done 3 movies together.
Yeah.
But essentially, well, anyway, the long and short of that is we went to Adelaide, and that's where we found out we were going to be parents, and
amazing,
and that was, you know, 2.5 years ago or 3 years ago. Anyway, we made that movie and had an amazing time, incredible experience. And but yeah, COVID was
a mad one, right?
Big thing, and that meant I was at home for longer than I had been in years.
Yeah,
and it was a good byproduct of all of that.
I think it's a really interesting thing about this industry, because it is an industry that doesn't really acknowledge the need for time off. I've got friends who become parents and are back on set, male or female, are back on set within, you know, a few weeks, a month, and that kind of thing. And it can be mad because of the pressures when you're responsible for so many other people's jobs, money, livelihood, everything. It can be a lot. So to have to have time off is kind of...
I had decided that the moment they came along, I was going to take at least like 5 or 6 months off.
Yeah.
Problem was, One of the exciting things for me was that as we finished The Stranger, I got a call from Ron Howard, was shooting a big movie in Australia, you know, in Queensland, the 13 Lives.
13 Lives.
And I almost didn't do it because I was going to have to cross the border, and Australia had all these sort of rules that if there was even one case of COVID, they might shut the border. And, and people were missing out on the birth of their children, funerals of loved ones. And so I almost was like, well, I'm not going to do it if there's even the slightest risk of that. Anyway, Ron has twins. I had twins. We'd found out by that point I had twins coming in. I don't know that that's why he was lenient on me, but he said, I will make sure that we as a production will make sure that everything will be, if you need to have the children up here or down there, whatever, we'll make it work.
Beautiful.
And they came 7 weeks early.
All right. More prep time. Perfect.
Yeah, but the problem was I hadn't finished shooting the movie yet.
Oh.
But they'd said if they came early, they would give me at least a week off. And all I had left when the kids came, you know, those guys put me on a plane, patted me on the back, everybody wished me well. And I said, all right, I'll promise you I'll be back in a week. And not knowing what was about to happen either, because there was a lot of fear around them coming early. And I just had 4 days left to shoot. So I was back at work a week after they were born, but only for three or four days of shooting. And I was just this emotional, like, wreck.
Yeah.
And also we're telling a story
about the rescue of 13,
a
soccer team, essentially.
Yeah.
That's a really emotional one. Like, it was watching it was a weird one for me, because I do get emotional in films all the time, but it really hit me at a weird time. It was as the last, like, it's weird. Like, I've always said it's weird that the Titanic is one of the biggest films ever, because we all know the ending.
Yeah.
It kind of proves that that's not what storytelling's about. It's not about this big twist. It's about how you tap into those emotions and tell the story.
Yes.
And it was mad on this. The last rescuer to come out in the film, I suddenly got overwhelming emotions, because it was that, right, everyone's kind of okay. That must be mad to be making a film like that about the world coming together to prioritize some young kids when, you know, you just have to bring some kids.
I remember
into
the first scene I had to shoot when I came back after the kids were born was I'm telling the Thai officials about the plan to anaesthetize the kids.
Yeah.
And he's asking me, will there be fatalities? And I look him square in the eye and I say, there will be. Yes, there'll be. So essentially some of them are going to die, which is what Harry believed. And I, you know, like a lot of actors, it's just like, you know, you go, oh, it's good. You know, every now and then it's okay to cry in a movie, and sometimes it's the right time, but other times it's not the right time and you want to hold it back. Yeah. And I just found myself so much more emotional than I ever normally am.
Yeah.
That I kept saying to Ron, I was like, can I just do it again? Normally it's like, can I do it again because I'm not producing the tears?
Yeah.
And then it was like, can I do it again because I want to not be, I don't want to be falling apart here.
Yeah.
But all, I just was so like, you know, I can't even describe it. It's like it suddenly I became a different human being.
There's such a beauty in that. My acting teacher trained under a guy called Yap Malgram, who also like taught like Anthony Hopkins and people like that. And they had a conversation at one point and it really was a breakthrough for me, because they kind of said they see so many drama students, particularly on stage, but so many drama students who are trying so hard to cry, and so many people in the real world who are trying so hard not to.
Yeah.
And the beauty in that, I guarantee that helped that scene and performance, because you didn't want to cry and you had to hold that back. And that's what Harry would have been doing, right? He wants to be a professional and deliver this in the moment. But yeah,
that was the beauty of Anthony Hopkins, instead of saying when in some of his most, you know, a lot of them, very stoic performances, he's like, he's in a situation where you go, oh, that guy should fall apart right now. Yeah. But because he doesn't, the audience falls apart.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
and you know
beautiful.
He can. You know he could just turn those tears on in a heartbeat, but it's that restraint to go, no, that's not what's right for the character.
Choose not to.
It's not me
choose
showing
not to
off.
Run.
Yeah.
It's like, but, you know, I remember at drama school, you know, you're reading all these books about acting and Mamet sort of really given the tough point of view on actors needing to cry, and saying the problem is that when they do manufacture the tears, that internally they're so proud of, he's essentially saying something akin to, they're so proud of themselves that then you're negating the feeling that you're supposed to be living in.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, look at me, I'm crying, I'm crying. Like in your head, you go, oh, look at me, I'm crying, I'm crying, I'm crying. But that's a joyful celebration of your abilities. And therefore, you're not really in the scene.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't win when Mamet talks about acting.
I was going to say.
He's right in theory so many times, but at the same time, you're like, yeah, but that's very cynical.
He's the perfect example because I think his books have taught me the most, but half the time it's me going, no, fuck off. I don't agree with you.
I mean, look, you know, when
I don't agree with your outlook on that. I believe there's more to it than this or whatever else.
And, yeah, like, I'm really into this theory of that there's sort of no acting required. Like if a story is, you know, the inflection of cuts as he talks about, and if a story is built perfectly, then essentially a central character should be able to move through a story as a statue and still evoke the right feelings from an audience. But at the same time, you end up in certain stories or films or whatever scenarios where you're like, I think there's some real acting required here, like some indication of emotion or something, you know, and it's a challenge to know when to choose those things or not. And some actors have an incredible instinct at it. I like to think that I my job, if I'm not certain, is to offer up options.
It's like,
I'm just going to do a bit of this and a bit of that and you decide, but hopefully you decide right.
Yeah. Well, one of the best bits of advice I got on set was actually off Tom Hardy, who you worked with in Warrior, which I think is another amazing film. And he kind of said, look, if you're not sure, don't do anything.
Mm.
And then either you could be directed or it will just pick up. Like if the writing is right, you might not, as you say, you might not need to act. You could, and then it's made me look back at so many of Tom's performances and see how much I've put on as a viewer where he's just held it, not done much. And you're like, oh, and you think of like Gosling in Drive and Fassbender in Shame and things like that. There's so many performances where loads of it, they're just not doing that much, but it's all in there. And that can be...
Yeah, one of my favourite actors I work with on Black Mass is Jesse Plemons.
Yeah.
And he's just such a confident comfortability in his performances where he's not really telling you too much. He's not giving away too much. But there's something so inviting, you know, as in you want to lean in to him. He's, I think he's extraordinary.
Philip Seymour Hoffman always comes to mind for that as well. Just such a, there's a curiosity there. He can explode and can give the huge performances he's known for, but so much of it is just, I want to know more about this guy. What's going on here?
Yeah.
We're going to go all over the place. It always happens this way. But you mentioned Mamet there and kind of learning. Just up the road here, a couple of months ago, I went to see The Pillow Man.
A
standing play. Are you tempted to go back to stage at all? Because you did The Pillow Man. Years back, right? Does stage appeal, or do you? And what are the differences, I guess, in your focus as an actor between stage and screen?
Last time I was on stage was 2010. I did Streetcar Named Desire in Sydney and Washington and in New York. And I reckon I've got a bit of sort of PTSD about that experience. It was mostly a wonderful experience. But doing that play in New York, I felt really kind of under the microscope, you know, for all the comparisons to, you know, the fact that play was first done in New York with Brando. And I just felt like, oh, I'm just sort of some cheap imitation coming in, you know, decades later to try and do a version of this. And I really started to get inside my head to a point where I stopped enjoying it in the last couple of weeks in New York. And it wasn't a pleasurable experience for me. And I had the same feeling I did Henry V in Australia, but it was a 5-month run. And that was more about a point of exhaustion. And I really drive myself into the ground doing theatre. I have this sort of weird feeling like every night has to be better and different for me. And like without thinking that each audience is a new group of people and that I don't need to reinvent it every night. And I'm not trying to reinvent it as in the blocking or go off book or any of that stuff. It's more about making sure that it's really truthful every time. And I tie myself in knots and I get very stressed about it. And it's like Groundhog Day where all day is about how, when I wake up, am I okay? How's my voice? How's my state of mind? And then you got to wait all day until the evening comes along and hope that you've reserved enough energy to do what you got to do. And then strangely, the moment the play starts, it's like, you know, whatever they say, doctor theatre, everything seems fine, but then the play's over and you've got to go and shake hands with everyone who says, you're wonderful and I don't believe them. And
yeah,
it's just a lot of stress for me. Whereas going to set on a movie is like a new task every day. Well, you know, part of my psyche is I'm like, I have to find a way to make this as best as I can do it in this moment today, because tomorrow we're going to be moving on to something else.
Yeah.
And I need to know that that piece for the edit, for the film, is as good as it can be and fits in the right way, in the right tone, and you get to move on to the next piece. And being on a movie set, the crew aren't there as an audience. They're like me, they're there to collect a piece to put in a bigger puzzle.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I'm being scrutinized or on show, and I don't feel nervous on a movie set. I have nerves about hitting a certain moment in a movie and making sure that I do it right, but I'm not feeling like terrified. I believe that I like to go to work feeling a little bit terrified, but not if it starts to consume everything in my life.
Yeah.
So, but that said, I have been thinking, how do I now, with the maturity I have as a, you know, almost 50-year-old man, go into a piece of theatre now with a different outlook on life, you know, with bigger priorities in my life, so that I can put it in a perspective that it belongs and still bring enough care to make it good. And the other thing is, every time I ever did a play, they were massive theatres. And I've never, since drama school, done a play in an intimate theatre.
Yeah.
And that's what I would like to do if I step back in.
It definitely sounds like that would be the way to go, right? The polar opposite of a play like Streetcar, where, as I said, it's going to be Brando comparisons regardless. That's going to get in your psyche regardless, in your performance, all of this. Whereas, yeah, a smaller production, a newer production, you could probably, yeah.
I remember hearing recently about this sort of Chekhov production that Andrew Scott did, and various things that pop up, and I'm just like, that entices me when I hear about that. It inspires me to go, that kind of thing would sound exciting. And not to say that what I'm looking to do is do every character in a whole play by myself without any cast members. But you hear about someone doing, either reinventing an old play or doing their own thing with an old play or a really interesting new play. And I do hear about those things and go, oh, that actually wouldn't be bad. I also wouldn't want to do a run that lasts for months and months and months.
That's what I like at the Duke of York's theatre up there, because I saw Vanya there as well. I saw Andrew Scott doing Vanya. That's where I saw The Pillow Man. And again, they do seem to be. They'll do a few weeks and then on to something else.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the ideal for the kind of actors they're getting in. I think that's ideal to get up there and scratch that itch.
Interesting, isn't it? Because in the old days, it was very hard to drag famous movie actors into the world of television. But then when they said, all right, well, we're only going to do like a limited season and then you can go off back to the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Suddenly all these actors that maybe looked down on television, or the more that they didn't want to do it because they didn't want to sign away 7 years of their life to the one character, they were like willing to go, I'm going to do True Detective. And now the world of television is different because of that 100%. And because of the streamers, you know.
Does television appeal to you much? Because you've not done loads in recent years, you know. Is it the appeal of, you know, a story that has a beginning, a middle and an end, you get to do your work and then move on to the next one? Or, you know, is there any lure of those? Because as I said, TV has become fucking amazing. Like the ability to really delve into characters and pick things apart is astounding now. So is there more appeal there, or do you still like the film?
Well, I jumped in an Underground Railroad because of Barry and the character and the world, and that felt like we were doing a long movie.
Yeah.
And then last year I shot sort of the real first proper television I've done in years, because I did TV in Australia back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I was like, I don't know about, I love that show, but I wanted to be in movies for the very thing that you just said. It's like each movie is a new mission, and then you sort of, you know, you move on to the next thing and you explore a new world, new rhythm and all sorts of stuff. And that's what I find exciting.
It's why I'm one of the only people, I think, who genuinely enjoys auditions and self-tapes, because it's even minier.
Yeah.
I get to just lose myself in that character and world for one moment. I'd love to come back to it, but if not, I've got to have that fun still. I've got to play there.
And you still got to do some work, you know, in a pleasurable sense.
Yeah.
I started reading a bit of TV because I started to understand that I was being a bit snobbish about it, because during the pandemic, I was watching a lot of television and I was starting to think, look, a majority of the television that I'm watching is of a standard that I think is higher than a lot of movies that I watch, the standard of writing, maybe because there's more than one brain working on the scripts, I don't know, but... And that you get to sit with and explore and live with the character for more than just an hour and a half, you know.
The difference of the power balance in TV and film between writer and director, like the writers are generally the showrunners in TV, so there is more
they're given a bit
dedication
of power
to the strict script, whereas with films it can be taken over by a production company or whatever else, and, you know, that can make amazing results, but it can also destroy something that would have been
With films, same with television, like there's some good and there's some not good. And even the things that are good, it all depends on your own taste, whether it really speaks to you or not.
Yeah.
And I read this thing, speculative science fiction writer, Blake Crouch, had written, called Dark Matter, which deals in sort of quantum mechanics and essentially a very grounded version of kind of a sliding doors concept the ability to, I call it multiverse for the middle-aged man. To explore themes of the choices you made in life and what if you had a chance to slide across and see what your life had been like if you had done a different thing.
Yeah.
Meaning chosen to not have a family.
Yeah.
And just focused on career in the case of the show. Anyway, we ended up making this show called Dark Matter based on his book. And he was the writer of most of the scripts and ran the show. And Jennifer Connelly and I play a husband and wife. And I play two versions of the same man.
Amazing.
One who chose family and child and a home life, and the other one who, you know, cut all that stuff out of his life to really pursue and focus on career.
Yeah.
And every episode is full of scenes that you may only find one or two of in a film.
Yeah.
And we did 9 episodes and it was the hardest I've ever worked in my life, because I was on set every day, almost every day, 5 days a week, all day long, playing two different versions of the same person, the kind of protagonist and the antagonist of the story. And I loved it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, well, I'm not going to be snobbish about television. I just sort of, my fear would be if you did too many of them, then you're kind of stacking up franchises in a way, because I know that we'll maybe, you know, if the audience receives it well, we'll go and do a second season and a third season. Maybe that would be the end of it, but it's still a commitment bigger than just one movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I loved it, and it was Apple and Sony, and they looked after us very well. We had great directors, and it was a different, you know, pace of working for sure. But it's the kind of TV show that if I wasn't in it, probably the kind of thing that I would go and watch during a pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
Or not a pandemic, you know.
Completely.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. So what interests me there, you're a writer and a director, a producer, an actor, all of these things. I can see how that project would appeal hugely as an actor. For me, it would appeal hugely as an actor. As a writer, that's my nightmare. A friend of mine, Joe Barton, wrote a series over here called The Lazarus Project, which is all time travel stuff.
Yeah.
I was watching it, adoring it, and messaging him going, are you all right? Because I can't imagine what it must have been like to write this with the different timelines and the overlaps and the crossovers and all that. It's kind of...
In almost every character.
To be on that side of it, but to get the script and go, trust you. I trust that this works.
Give me a piece of paper and I'll draw you a tree, but I'm not going to draw you an Escher, you know, staircase. Yeah. And that's what it was like for him, I'm sure. But that's how Blake's brain works. And, you know, understanding not only all the intersections and crossovers of characters, but how each character's life is slightly different or morphed or dramatically different from one version of the Chicago timeline to an alternate version. So it's not about traveling backwards and forwards in time. It's about sliding laterally to a world where you may go right up to your front door and it looks exactly the way it is, and you walk in the living room and it's exactly the way it is, but there's just something ever so slightly different. Like you're so adjacent to your version of the world, but not quite close. And other versions where it's like the couldn't be more different. And the world building, and what's interesting about the series is that it starts in very real world Chicago. And episode two, you know, still lives in the real world, but it's expanding a little bit. And by sort of episode four, you're in these sort of worlds that are so dramatically different, but it's still Chicago. And it goes, the show expands like some massive labyrinth that is really exciting. But like I said, it's grounded. So it's like instead of some superhero kind of whizzing around the universe, it's just a average middle-aged family guy trying to get his own life back from himself. And it's interesting. It's really fascinating shit, you know.
Sounds great. Mm. Well, I mean, I want to get on to talking about the boys on the boat, in the boat, because I adored it. But just before we do, you mentioned, you said kind of, you know, a drastically different reality. We started this conversation talking about the pandemic. I just want to kind of see how you found being in Australia for that. Because from the outside, I feel Australia and New Zealand are probably the people who handled it the best in the world. But it was also the strictest. Again, I sit here, I was filming in Canada when it started, but thankfully got back to the UK and then had to witness how, in my opinion, we didn't handle it well at all. Mm. The government didn't prioritise the people, they prioritised the economy or themselves. How was that being out there? And did you feel that despite the harshness of it all, you guys were doing the right thing? Whereas you look at America was a prime example of, as well, of who didn't seem to be doing it.
I was watching,
in my opinion,
this COVID statistician, you know. Every morning I'm looking at the people that were losing their lives every day, like incredible numbers, and watching how Australia was handling it, despite what your politics is and whether you believed it was true or false. I didn't believe there was a hoax. I believed it was, you know, really going on, and I was happy to be put in a position where everyone was going, we're all going to be safe. Now, Australia is full of, even though we like to think that, you know, because modern European Australia was a penal colony of, you know, criminals, but really bad criminals, because they got caught just stealing a fork and, you know, kicking a sheep. Yeah. No, they weren't like really cunning criminals.
Yeah.
But we're actually not really a rebellious nation.
Yeah.
And we're not divided or polarized in the same way that America is right now. So when the government says do something, 99% of the people go, okay, so stay home. Okay. You know, none of this like 50% going okay and the others are going, no, wearing a mask means you're in bed with the devil or whatever. So everyone was compliant and it was safe for a while. The only negative thing I would say is that when I eventually was able to kind of like a mouse or a, you know, bear at the end of kind of the winter, poke my head out of my cave and go, it's safe to go out into the real world, I was terrified.
Right.
And I'm sure people in the States who had kind of just sucked it up a little bit more and become sort of more hard bitten were wondering why I was so paranoid to kind of stand within 2 meters of somebody. And, you know, so I was a little bit, I was paranoid. But look, I think Australia handled it pretty well. And then it all just suddenly, it's funny how I was in London in the beginning of last year about to shoot Boys in the Boat. And it was probably one of the worst moments for COVID at the time, but it had been the moment where everyone went, well, let's just get on with things.
Yeah.
And it was like no one was seeming like there was anything wrong, but everyone had COVID. We all got it on the film after having one dinner with all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, every day you turn up and you're like, where's George? He said home. And, you know, the weird thing was on a movie set, the rules are, you know, it's like, you know, you can't say, you know, someone else has a medical thing. You can't talk about other people's medical stuff.
It's privacy.
So it was this funny conversation. So I was like, where's George today? He's like, he's at home. He's the director of the movie. So has he got COVID? He's like, I can't say.
He's at home.
It's like, so he's got COVID. I can't say, yeah. But he's got COVID. <It's> like,
if it was something else, you'd be able to say.
Yeah. But, you know, like, the COVID, you know, it was such a strange time. And like, you know, I being Australian, there was very few people that if you're Australian that you knew were actually really deeply affected by it.
Yeah.
Whereas I know people from here and from the States who lost significant people in their family, close loved ones, or had massive long COVID that's really affected their ability to move in the world. We were very lucky that we had such a strict policy, and a lot of people judged that policy. And I had a funny moment where my partner got an exemption to leave to Europe to do work, because you had to really apply.
Yeah.
You've got to state your case. Why do you want to leave the country? Mm-hmm. But when you come back, you got to go to a hotel that you don't choose, put in a room that you might hate for 2 weeks, and you pay $3,000 yourself for the privilege of having to do that.
Yeah.
And you might get a room in a basement facing a brick wall, or you might get the penthouse suite, but it's a gamble. My partner's got good karma. Everything she wants, you know, sort of somehow the universe gives it to her.
Yeah.
Which is why I think we have twins, and one's a boy and one's a girl.
Yeah.
And it's like she just sort of, I joke about it, but I think she's got some kind of good karma that's coming back to her from something. Anyway, she came back and was put in this incredible room with an amazing view, and I just became her delivery guy. I'd bring her boxes of food and bought her things. I brought her some clay so she could make some pots. She was having a little craft workshop up there.
Amazing.
I printed off 3 joke shots of my face, like I was doing an actor's sort of headshot, and framed them so she could put them in a room. And as I delivered a box one day to the front desk, there was this very clean looking hotel guy, and he's like, you know, what have you got in here? And I told him, and he looked really stressed, and I said, are you okay? And he goes, oh, the guy has gone level 16. It's like he's all angry because, you know, he doesn't know why he can only have a six-pack of beer every day. That was the limit, one bottle of red wine or a six-pack.
Right.
And he goes, you'd think 6 would be enough. And I looked at his complexion and I was like, clearly he's not a drinker. Because there were people who were probably opening a can at like, you know, 9 in the morning, and then they're out by lunchtime.
You've got nowhere to go and nothing you can do.
And then he pulled out this little cutting knife that I had in there because I'd given her some bread and some cheese. And he said, oh, you can't have this. And I naively was like, why? And he's, you know, that there had been people up there in forced quarantine who had tried to kill themselves.
Wow.
I don't know specifically in that hotel, but it was a policy.
Yeah.
No sharp items. And I was like, wow. And it really struck me. And I had another situation with someone in my neighborhood, had a woman coming with her 4 kids in her car because she'd escaped her home because of her husband.
Right.
Because the increase of domestic violence had just spiked.
It was huge.
You know, my partner and I had the kind of opposite situation where we realized we were spending 24 hours a day in the same house together, and it became something that made our relationship better. I was like, I love this person, but I also actually really, really like her and happy to spend all this time, and I'm happy I'm nowhere else.
It's good to have that confirmed.
But, you know, to see other people's experiences, that it became, for some people, it became a prison that exacerbated things for them that, you know, put life on edge.
Yeah, it put everything under a microscope.
Mental health issues.
For better or worse, yeah.
I definitely had a lot of good times, and then it started to undulate for me. But, the other great thing I think came out of it was, you know, we were able to go and, like, you know, exercise and do that stuff. It's like realizing a lot of men that I hung out with were really opening up more about their, you know, things that were important to them, talking about isolation and mental health and concerns about the future, and, you know, conversation started to sort of go deeper than the normal surface level of things
because
stuff was going on. And I appreciated that, having that forum as well.
Yeah. I swear this isn't a podcast purely about COVID, but we will get on to film stuff. But
what are your stats? How many times you have it?
Or how did you find the yoga? Because I got into yoga when I was filming in Canada during COVID. And because I'm into my exercise and into keeping fit, I hadn't realised how unflexible I am, because, again, it's that weird thing of when you are focusing on muscle or strength, it can be at the cost of flexibility if you're not stretching enough and all these things that we're all meant to do, yeah. but maybe don't do because we just want to get in the gym for an hour or whatever else.
Yeah. So, I won't go to a gym anymore. I mean, I have at this hotel because I'm here.
Yeah.
But now I just buy equipment and leave it at my house. And yeah. But during COVID, I just did at least like half an hour of yoga practice on my own each day.
Yeah.
And I realized after a year, I had managed to do it almost every single day. I think I missed like 2 or 3 days. And I get in an obsessive rhythm with things.
Yeah.
Like if I do something twice, then chances are I'll do it a third time the next day and then again and again. Yeah. It'll become a pattern. But it was a happy pattern for me and I loved it. And I stopped sort of doing the other kind of exercise except running. And actually I got together with these two dudes, one of whom I knew really well, Jim. He's an older guy. And we used to swim across this cove in Sydney and do like a 2 kilometre swim each day.
Wow. Yeah,
and we kept doing it as it got to the winter months and the water would have been like 12, 13 degrees.
Yeah.
And Jim was swimming with this guy who'd had a motorcycle accident and a stroke as a result of the accident. And every day he would get in the water and swim 2 kilometres. It would take him longer than it took Jim and I to do it. And it was like, because I was watching it, not because I'm a bit competitive either, but I was like, look, if he's doing it, I've got no excuse. And the three of us were like this weird sort of trio that would go down to this cove and swim every day. And it was one of the things I regretted about finally going out into the rest of the world is I left my little swimming gang.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was amazing. And just going, okay, well, it's getting colder.
Again, for body and mind, though, again, like I love cold water swims for exactly that. It's that it just
yeah. makes it's the one thing, and I'm no like fitness guru by any stretch, but, you know, I do adamantly believe that exercise is a tonic that is beneficial in so many ways, and that if you're feeling not great, that moving your body or putting yourself through a physical challenge of some kind is gonna reboot you in some way, distract you. It has all these benefits, and one of them is that it gives you a sense of pride.
Yeah,
you know, I did that.
Yeah,
I checked that box today. So like I'm a real advocate for that. For people to kind of help them through a time, like whatever it is, you know, rather than just sit down and wallow and get unhealthy.
Yeah, I agree. Well, check this segue out. Speaking of obsessive rhythms, the boys in the boat, I loved it. And I didn't know if I would. Like everyone involved in it, I'm a big fan of. I think George is a fantastic director, but I've got no real connection to Rowan. But there's something about sports films that I think is so draws you in. It's so powerful. It hits all the emotions.
Yeah.
How is that to be part of someone? And when it's a true story, again, it's that thing that really you get those emotions and you feel it. You know.
Well, here's the thing. I reckon. You know, when we made Warrior, I know tons of people who were reluctant to see it because they're like, "I'm not into MMA." But the film's not about MMA. You know, the film is about family and other things. The sport is the garnish, you know. I became obsessed with Queen's Gambit. I appreciate chess, but I never thought it would be gripping. And then, you know, if you made a movie about knuckles or tossing a coin in the right hands,
conquers the
you know,
movie.
If there's a theme or a real substance behind it, it's great. And I did think, you know, who cares about rowing, but it's not about the rowing. The rowing is just the kind of the thing that tells us a story about overcoming adversity and, you know, forming a family and operating as a group and appreciating, you know, who you're in the boat with or who you're on your team with and all that stuff. It also happens to be done in a really cinematic way, and I feel like the movie itself is like a rowing race. It moves with this building rhythm in a way that it never slows down. And it keeps building, keeps giving you new obstacles. And it's a pleasure to watch. And when you even just tell someone the story of this, particularly when it ends in front of Hitler getting pissed off, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. There's so many themes like that. Like it's a story of working class people overcoming privileged people, which is always a story I'm disposed to kind of thing because, you know, it's just a natural joy. And then, yeah, as I said, it ends at the Berlin Olympics and all that. So did you come out of it a fan of rowing? Because it was weird timing for me. I'd done the this year I've done the first bits of rowing I think I've ever done as a grown-up. And it was just like on little boat trips kind of thing. It was I guess I'm rowing. And I'll tell you the truth, arrogantly, there was moments on both of the rowing trips I've done that I thought, I'm a bit of a natural. You know,
you'd be the
I've got a good frame for it.
You have a perfect frame for it.
Watching this and the way it was shot and the points where he's hitting the thing on the side of the boat and getting the rhythm, it made me want to go and row, which again, I don't often have that feeling. But did it get you into rowing? Because you do get to understand the nuance of it a bit more.
Yeah, look, I would say more that I appreciate it and understand it in a way that I never used to. Yeah. I mean, I knew what rowing was, obviously, but I didn't really know about what goes into it, what kind of training would go into it, what kind of mechanics are involved. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure if I get a chance or it's on the television and I see rowing race, I'm more likely going to watch it now than I ever would before.
Yeah.
Am I going to become a rower? I don't know. I get, every now and then if I am like hotel gym and there's a rowing machine, I'll get on it. But I just appreciate the skill involved, man. It's like it really is. There's no other sport. Like you think about all the team sports, everybody – a collection of different shapes and sizes that suit their different role in a certain line, whatever the game is, you know, tall, if you're this, you're that, you could be a goalkeeper. And, you know, the halfback in rugby league is a particular kind of body type. Rowing is like a boy band that are doing a dance perfectly in sync, you know what I mean? There's no other sport
that's a really physical dance.
Yeah, they become like this sort of caterpillar. Yeah. Where everything's tuk-tuk-tuk-tuk, everybody's got to be on point. And if anybody's rolling their wrist wrong or has the wrong posture, it can throw the entire game out.
That was the bits that got me. Seeing the rolling of the wrist technique made me go, I want to go out and do some rowing, because I wasn't doing that when I was rowing.
I reckon I can
get some extra time on there next time I'm on the rivers of Cambridge.
But I loved about it was that, because I'd been through the experience with Warrior, is I know the pleasure that comes from the pain of putting yourself through the challenge.
Yeah.
And that someone's paying you to get in a really serious routine where you're going to learn a skill, you're going to bond with a bunch of other people, and you're going to transform in some way in terms of your understanding of something and your physical transformation. And it's hard work. Mm. But if you go through it, there's a huge amount of big barrel of pride, satisfaction and knowledge coming waiting for you throughout and at the end. And I just admired that these boys were going through that and that they all took to it. No one kind of was too precious to do it.
I think more often than not, it's a dream role, isn't it? To get to do something that you get to transform into the character more. So there is more, rather than just you turn up and you're the character, some kind of journey.
Yeah, I mean,
there is
a world where George would have, you know, a movie that looks less good and maybe has less of a sense of camaraderie with his characters, where they turn up and go, okay, just, you know, where do I hold this oar? And all right, let's shoot. There are things you can fake in movies, obviously. And, you know, this is like, there are certain things you could turn up in the morning and go, just show me how to do this one thing and I'll make the audience believe me. But big physical things like this and the shape of their bodies and the way they need to look, it's a different – you got to turn up months ahead of time.
Yeah.
And it's so cool. And I was sort of going, all right, well, this is one of the silver linings of being a little bit older, is I get to be the coach. And I get to look cool in a three-piece suit and just stand off the side and yell at everyone. So I didn't have to go through all the physical training. I'd train a bit with them in the gym and do all the, you know, go watch them train. I did a bit of single scull rowing because there was a plan at some point. We shot one piece where I row out in the river just to kind of have a look at the conditions, not because I'm trying to belt down the lane, but just sort of seeing what the currents are like. So I did a bit of rowing. But most of my fascination became about these two lines in the script that talked about how little Ulbrichtsen smiled.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, good, this is the reason I really wanted to be involved, because I wanted to play one of those coaches that just looked like he was having a terrible time.
Yeah.
You know, and we all know those coaches, they're the ones that care the most.
Yeah.
And they look like they're willing to drive themselves to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
Because they just love the sport and they love their team, but it doesn't show on them at all. Yeah. They look like they'd rather be anywhere else.
Yeah. But then the value when coach smiles at his wife is then through the roof. It means so much more because you've got that moment.
Or when he just says to them, you know, for what it's worth, I'm proud of you boys.
Yeah.
Is that moment when, you know, you see coaches sort of sharing the, you know, the trophy with their team and you go, oh, finally I saw that guy's teeth.
Yeah,
he's a happy guy because he won.
Well, that's one of the things I liked about this was he's not a coach that's got these constant big rousing speeches. If anything, it's laughed at how it's underwhelming his speeches are at points. It's like, here's the facts. It's like, you know, let them know you care kind of thing. That's so people like, but, and that was a nice change in the sports film because it's normally about you build up to that big speech before the big row. And
I don't know how you feel, and I know this is sort of a kind of a thing all around the world, but you know, the general non-verbal nature of fathers, you know, and coaches are fathers to me.
Yeah.
You know, male coaches are fathers with in many regards. And my father's a very emotional and open man and willing to talk about things, but he's not verbose, you know, he's not a sort of an essay of words on every subject. So a hand on my shoulder with a little squeeze says a volume of things to me that can easily trigger me in an emotional way. And just telling me that, you know, I did a good job or he's proud of me, you know, that means so much. I think there's something in the non-verbal space that we're looking for guides from people that are guides to us.
Yeah.
And parents are guides and coaches are guides. So when they're hard to read, we're projecting that, I'm not doing good enough, you know, I've got to be better, I've got to be smarter, I've got to be funnier, whatever. And that silence, you fill it with effort because you're like, I want to see you smile at me. I want to see you tell me that I'm good, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's, to me, why some coaches, you know, the angriest ones are sometimes the winningest ones because their team is like, I don't want you to be so upset with me all the time.
And again, it adds value when they do have those moments because it's not in their nature and you know they're having to try. I know I've had, like, so my dad's generation and the generation before him aren't big huggers and things like that. And in recent years, my dad has consciously decided he's going to hug us more and show that emotion. And I had a moment earlier in this year where I'd had kind of a rough year and my dad was around mine and my brother was around mine. And my brother was cooking and my dad comes in and we all have a bit of a chat and a catch up. And then we're about to go in the living room and it's clear that my dad had thought he'd thought on the way round, he knows I'm having a rough time, he wants to give me a hug. But you generally do that on arrival, right? So we walk into the living room and just before he takes off his coat, he's like, and gives me a hug. And it was kind of awkward and weird, but kind of all the more beautiful because it wasn't just, here's the natural thing. It was him consciously saying, I want to give my son a hug to say it's all right to be feeling these emotions and this kind of thing. And that kind of thing, it's just, it means more, right?
Yeah, it's big.
So playing kind of a paternal role like that, how was the atmosphere on set? Did you slot into kind of a paternal role as amongst the actors? Because again, a lot of younger guys, a lot of newer guys, amazing talent across the board. But did you slot into that paternal role on set as well?
Well, I'm aware that I've, you know, been around for a while and I'm aware that, you know, like young guys coming up, you know, like I did when I was their age, or like a lot of them are not that young, but when I was in my early 20s, I looked up to other male actors and, you know, I've seen certain things they'd done. And if I got a chance to work with someone like that, it was a real pleasure. And I sometimes forget that I'm now that to a younger generation of actors. I don't ever carry that with me thinking in a bragging way, but I started to feel like some of these guys were excited that I was in the movie and that made me flattered. And I was like, I've been around enough that maybe there's a few things they'd seen and that they were happy to work with me. So they projected that onto me.
Great.
Anyway, I think when I was doing little moments or scenes with them, I think like the boys in the film, they were eager to kind of match, you know, to do the right thing in the scene. I think most actors always feel like they're trying to get the most out of themselves and don't presume that they've got everything covered easily, you know. Like, so I'm concerned about making sure I do the right thing too, but I think they think I'm made of Teflon and they're the new kids on the block, you know.
Exactly.
And I could feel that. And I felt that admiration from them that made me I'm now like a middle-aged actor that's been around a while. Because I've always got this idea in my head that I'm still a baby and I'm not, you know.
Yeah. That's these industries. Are they right? I came from music doing rap into film and they're all Peter Pan industries. They're all industries where we get to not really acknowledge that we're we're growing up, we get to just keep playing.
Yeah, no, you know? I think also part of, you know, part of the responsibility is knowing yourself, you know, which I think is a challenge just in life, not even just about work. It's like knowing yourself, not checking out and just going, okay, well, I'm getting older, so my job is to get cynical and unfit and unhealthy and I'm just getting closer to death. And I'm not talking about that, but knowing how, for example, in cinema, how do I present when a camera is pointed at me and what roles do I play? And still, again, not to put yourself in a box, challenge yourself within that. But now I'm a guy who's almost 50. Now what do I get to explore now that I haven't had a chance to explore before? Yeah. And what do I happily let go of that I can let go of, that I'm not, I can't see myself as that thing anymore that's of a different generation? Doesn't mean to say I don't have access to change rhythms and energies and, but there's a whole world of characters now that are available to me. And now that I'm a dad, I have this real relationship with the idea of being a father that changes the things that I'm interested in doing. You know, I read stories about parenthood now, or relationships between fathers and children that have a much bigger impact on me, that now I'm like, I want to tell those stories. And now as I write, you know, characters that I'm writing now have children, whereas 10 years ago I was maybe writing characters that didn't have children.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's changed things. And I really like to think that a way to kind of participate in the best way is to start to really continue to know yourself as you evolve.
It's not always easy though, right? Like I know I've got one script that I've written, that the character I've got in mind for me in it, because things take a long time to get made. I'm a couple of years away from having to acknowledge it's not me anymore. It's someone else in that role, that character. Like at the time I wrote it, I was like, this is perfect. I'll smash this role. It'll be ideal. And it's that few years I'm like, oh, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe this might have to be a writer, director, and not actor thing. So
yeah,
because it's,
we did that with The King. David Michaud and I had started working on The King probably 7 years before we made it.
Right.
And I was sort of getting a bit too old to play Henry V anyway, because he was super young. He was like in his early 30s when he became the king, or younger even. Anyway, I sort of had played that character on stage at the age of 22, I think. And then I was like, we'd written the movie and we changed it in our own way and all that stuff for all sorts of reasons. But then I started to realize can't do that anymore. I think part of the drama of that is a young man put in this position of power, and that it will diffuse some of that power if he seems like a more capable, older, experienced of life man. So then I was like, well, you know, maybe I'm too young to do the false start thing, and I'll have to eat a lot of food. And then, but then when we started to explore what defined an old man in that era, I was like, yeah, I would have been an old man. I was at the end of life expectancy. Whereas, you know, the understanding from a modern person is that, oh, if you're playing an old man, he should be in his like 60s or 70s. Yeah. Like, no, like being your late 40s was like, you lived a good life, man. So I was like, I slid across.
Yeah.
You know, which I did selfishly because I was involved in creating it, you know, whether I was the best person for the job or not, I don't care.
Well, I mean, you speak of becoming an actor that people maybe see attached to a project and be excited to work with. George Clooney is one of those people for you, right? And I really enjoyed Master Gardener as well, and you've got Sigourney Weaver in there and people like that. Are there people that you see attached and go, oh, that's kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Exciting and a buzz. What comes to mind for that?
Absolutely. I mean, I could probably type out a list of hundreds of actors that if you said, oh, you'd like, you know, do you want to do a movie with this person? I'd be like, yeah. I mean, I was in a room last night at some after party. I went with my partner to the London Fashion Awards.
And
there was even a few actors in that room. I was like, oh, can you just imagine, you know, what's the story where we could do something together?
Yeah.
And they're not just older actors that I've grown up watching, you know, like Meryl Streep and, you know, I mean, I'm a huge fan, obviously, as the whole world is, of Mark Rylance. And
yeah.
There's so many. I was at the Marrakesh Film Festival and saw Willem Dafoe and I'd be like, oh, that'd be a dream too. You know, there's so many. I'd have a big list. But also contemporaries of mine and younger actors.
Yeah.
You know, all across the board, I see young performers and just go, oh, man, that, the things that person's capable of, you know, I've become really, you know, relatively good mates with Barry Keoghan. And, you know, there's people on the internet who reckon we're, you know, cut from the same physical family cloth.
Yeah.
That we must share some DNA. And I can sort of see that too. And,
yeah,
you know, so we've sort of talked a bit about, like, what is the thing that we could do together?
100%.
And I just love him and I'm really fascinated by what goes on in his mind when he's in front of a camera.
I completely agree. I had him on the podcast years ago and we're both big MMA fans and I can't remember if it was on podcast or off, we were just nerding out about that for a while. And he's got that feel of, even back then, he's got that feel of, there's an actor and comedian, Gaz Khan, and we worked together years ago and we would always say, you know, when you meet someone and they're real or proper, as we'll say here. Barry is that. He's got all this talent. He's can't miss at the moment. I thought The Green Knight, another great film. I thought Barry, and that was just astounding. And then Saltburn recently, everything. He's flying.
You know, and the other person I thought was great in that was this Jacob. I thought he was just extraordinary in that. There's something about Barry, and every now and then there are actors, and you brought up Philip Seymour Hoffman. There's other actors that have been around the day, you know, Gary Oldman and, you know, heroes old and new is that there's something about certain people and they're in front of the camera, whatever character they're playing, and you just find yourself leaning in and wanting to get inside their brain.
Yeah.
And they can, and then they've got you in the palm of their hand. And I don't know that there's a certain amount of craft and skill that goes into that. There's a certain amount of, you know, je ne sais quoi. You know, who knows what it is. Ben Mendelsohn is one of the best at that. You know, like whatever he does, he invites you in, you lean in and you don't want to look away.
I couldn't agree more. He's one of my most kind of studied actors that I'm kind of, because I'll always watch him and think, I love that, but I don't know what he's done there.
Don't know why,
I need to have another look and go, well, what is it about that? But you speak of Barry, you know, yourself and maybe Ben all feeling like you kind of cut from similar cloth. Do you think it's because you all come from islands that start where you started off, you're making stuff for just your own country? Like there's loads of stuff that obviously now the internet is making everything everywhere, but Ireland and Australia have had some of the most amazing shows. Love and Hate in Australia, which Barry was in, and loads of different things, Underbelly in Australia and things like that, that if they were American, that'd be talked about alongside The Sopranos and things like this. But there's this thing of making stuff for us, and then you happen to then get exposed into the rest of the world. So rather than you're setting out going, I want to go to Hollywood, I want to be in Hollywood, do you think that's the essence?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, like obviously, you know, and, you know, Barry's talked about his life, his past, his growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's had experience in his life. Yeah. He's, like, lived in the real world in very significant ways, as we all do. But there's a complexity to him. There's a complexity to certain people. And there are actors that don't necessarily, you know, like they always used to say, people used to talk about how actors need to have been through torture in order to be good at what they do. And I don't believe that's true.
No.
I believe that I'd be more inclined to say that, you have to be inquisitive, observant and empathetic and maybe a few other words. But those things, I think,
there's a quote I've always loved, observation, not old age, brings wisdom.
Mm.
And I think that sums it up. It doesn't have to be that you've been around forever. It's just that you've been paying attention.
No.
And that's the same thing. It doesn't mean you have to have gone through hell, but you need to be paying attention.
And I think you need to be a curious mind. And through that and the right dose of empathy, you also can get to a place where you're not judging who you are pretending to be.
Mm.
And you're investigating, you know, what makes that character interesting and how do you build them into a real person? And how do you integrate them with who you are, how you look and sound,
yeah.
And also, like, how does that character live inside your whole body and not just in your face or in the words that come out of your mouth? And I don't know. I don't even know. Sometimes I think actors are in control of what they do, and sometimes maybe there's elements that they are out of control of, that they are unaware of how electrifying and interesting they can be. You know, and I just pulled my contact lens out, which doesn't matter on a podcast.
Still, not ideal for you.
I'm going to wink like a pirate. I'm just going to take it out. That you get, the Australian show. Have you been on to my brother's show called Mr. In Between?
No, I haven't. I'm familiar with it. But
half
I've
hours,
heard of it.
Three seasons, unbelievable Australian show.
Yeah.
In fact, I was very excited the other day. My brother sent me this video that was Ricky Gervais talking about stuff that he likes, saying without a doubt, I think it was last year, that his favourite thing that he'd seen was my brother's show and had binge-watched the whole three seasons. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
I'm on it next. Have you seen the recent David Holmes documentary, The Boy Who Lived?
No.
It's the guy who was the stuntman for Daniel Radcliffe. And your brother is also a stuntman, you know, so it's...
It's always been a concern. My scariest moments on set, without a doubt, is watching my brother being painted with fire retardant.
Right.
In anticipation for being set on fire.
Yeah.
And I was really, really scared.
It must
hit
different
when it's...
Like,
they're all playing it safe and like, but there's always that what if.
Yeah.
And I've met two stunt guys through my brother who are now no longer walking on Earth because of accidents on set. And I've met another one who's severely brain damaged, who got injured during a movie. And knowing that, you know, less so nowadays, my brother's more, you know, directing than actually stunt performing. But always knowing that was a possibility. That's why they get a bit of extra money to
They're only just starting to get a bit of extra credit, like with stunts becoming a category in so many awards and things like that. It's been overlooked for so... I think, weird comparison, but stunts and casting are two such crucial parts of productions that for so long have been overlooked and are only just starting to get awards and pats on the back, at least.
And they're the... You know, they're the... they're really the kind of guys that don't complain on a set. You know, like, it's almost like a requisite for an actor to be like, oh, it's too cold, or it's too this, it's too that, I can't do that. I've said, because I know a lot of extra stunt guys beyond just the ones I've worked with through my brother. You know, you get stunt guys, like the guy that doubled me on Dark Matter.
Right.
You know that there were certain days that he was really injured, but he just wouldn't let on.
Yeah.
I had to milk it out of him. I was like, are you okay? Because I saw him do some weird stretch and he was grimacing and off to the side in the darkness. I'm like, you okay? He's like, I'm like, you know, pry it out of him that he really wrenched his neck. But, you know, an actor would be the first one to tell you, oh, I wrenched my neck. Oh, no, 100%. I need a day off.
I'm feeling rough.
Whereas those guys would just keep sucking it up.
And just the knowledge as well. I had a little indie project I was doing in France once that I turned up one day and found out I was doing a stunt because we didn't have a stunt crew.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, here's where we're practicing. And I'm lucky that Jacob Tamuri is a mate who's amazing stuntman. Amazing. So I sent him some messages, and just the messages he sent me improved. Like, I only had half a day of learning it. Yeah. But the notes he gave me on this particular fall, where it's pick a point to focus your eyes on so your head doesn't just roll back and things like this. The small little nuances made all the difference.
Little
and that
tips.
Was just a casual, here's how you, like, without having to learn the whole stunt or anything else, just go, here's the things that will make that better and safer. It's...
They're good guys, man.
Amazing.
They're just, I don't, you know, and maybe the not good stunt guys or the careless ones or the kind of arrogant ones don't, you just never see them on a set because people don't like the work. But the ones that are working, they work hard. They're so helpful. They're tireless. And of course, they take the hits for us.
Yeah.
But I have such admiration for them.
Yeah.
Just incredible. And they'll be the first and last on set if they have to be, without complaining, ever.
Yeah.
And they don't have the cushy trailers sometimes, and they're lugging equipment. And they're just like, I just got full respect for stunt guys.
Yeah, completely agree. Well, I don't want us to run out of time without kind of asking you about you as a writer and director. Mm. Because I think The Gift and Boy Erased are two of your best performances on screen, and so you can clearly do both at once if the project is right. Like you mentioned David earlier, who you've worked with a load on Animal Kingdom and The King. What's ahead in that front? Is there stuff that you is? Are there stories you're wanting to tell? Have you got plans for more writing and directing? And
yeah, I've got a couple of. I started producing a bit.
I
produced a TV series that's coming out in Australia. It was very much a kind of a backseat producer, but I was very much involved in the early stages of this TV series called. Why did my brain not work? Boy Swallows Universe.
Right.
Everything I have has got a boy in it these days.
Yeah.
Boy Swallows Universe. Based on an Australian novel. I am in very heavily involved in this really interesting documentary project that will probably come up next year that's been made called Daughters, which strangely I tracked this woman down after seeing a TED Talk where she talks about she runs a program for young girls in Virginia where they ended up writing a letter to a sheriff in the prison because one of the girls' fathers was incarcerated and they ended up, right. He agreed to let a whole bunch of girls come into the prison to have a sort of a dance and a day of activities with their dads.
Wow.
And I went to the prison event in 2019, just before COVID, and was there and there was a documentary crew and I was just there to observe and to help because I was fascinated by this and I'd become friends with this woman. Anyway, this is an incredible documentary that sort of speaks to the separation of families, particularly in the African-American community and the difficulty of connecting with family when you're incarcerated and how it affects children. So that's called Daughters, and I'm a producer on that. David Michaud and I had written a story that he's directed a movie called Wizards that A24.
With Sean again, right?
With Sean again.
Yeah.
But I'm not in that one. Right. I was busy with George, sadly. Yeah. So there's that. And then, but on a personal level, I've just been dying to write and direct another movie. And I've written a bunch during COVID. I wrote a few things, not things that I'm ready to direct. I was like, I like this, but I don't think it's the right next movie. But I had the kids and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do it until they're at school. I just didn't have the capacity.
Yeah.
As much as I had the intention, I just knew I wouldn't have the availability in my life to do it. So I've now written something that I want to make. It's very much in the tone of The Gift. And in a similar sense, it trades in a sort of a genre, the genre of, I guess, psychological suspense, tipping on into the horror, but not really. But that's sort of about something that's important to me, which is, essentially I want to make a movie that speaks to why any one of us are only one or two steps away from committing acts of violence if we're tipped in the wrong direction. And just looking at, kind of the average social human animal.
Yeah.
And like, why do we see these things happen that we read about and go, oh my God, someone stabbed someone over, having their lane taken from them on a highway.
Yeah.
And it's not a movie about road rage, but essentially the whole, what I want to make is sort of kind of a movie that's essentially a kind of a rage in some way, and but with elements of mystery and suspense to it.
So. Such a fascinating topic because I think the way we absorb media now means we dehumanize everything and we don't see how close we are. Like everyone's a villain. I mean, in London at the moment, the homeless community are a prime example of this. You can't imagine. It's they're so dehumanized now, particularly by our current government, that you don't realize until you work with the homeless or talk to some homeless people or whatever, that we could all be so close to that, or so many of us are a number of mistakes away from being that. And I feel that with almost every horrific thing that happens. Not that I'm on the edge and I'm about to go on a killing spree, but I can see the steps.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I see these things and go, that's horrific. But also, I wonder who they were the week before or the month before.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm really interested too in the pettiness of middle class.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like I often say, like if I have any issues, I very much consider myself middle class, even though I'm in the world of the arts field, which sort of makes you feel like you're in a floating island of weirdness.
Yeah.
But I'm middle class, I'm a white middle class male. And these sort of petty concerns that I see in the middle class, you know, and it's easy to say to someone, hey, you know, but look at the newspaper and look at what other people are going through. And you do go, oh yeah, I'm even if this is happening in my life or I have this stress or my kitchen's flooding or whatever, like I'm still one of the luckiest dudes that I know. But that's not to say that your own stresses aren't relative to your own sphere of thinking.
Yeah.
But I'm really interested in how there's a certain pettiness that you can observe in someone like Maya's life who goes, oh, I'm all frustrated about this. Yeah. You're like, you're actually okay, dude. Well, like, fucking settle down. But then people like me or people in, you know, that look like me that have a big, you know, a middle-class cushy life, do these fucking crazy things. And you're just like, there's this stress that lives in all of us. And every now and then, you might realize you're the person that is the straw that broke someone's back.
Yeah.
You know, you're the tipping point. And it's not about you.
Yeah.
You just happen to come along at a moment when that person was ready to fucking blow.
Yeah.
And then the next day they wake up and realize, why did I do that thing? Yeah, like, why did I do that? Like, if I'd have just had a nice long sleep and looked at myself in relationship to the rest of the world, I'm pretty good,
yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of people get overly concerned by small things, but stress is real.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's why road rage is the prime example of that, because we're going fast, so we've got less time to calm down and think about it and go, oh, this is petty or stupid.
Mm.
We're speeding along, but the pettiness fascinates me. It's so weird. So. This evening, I'm recording my big end of year podcast, which is just me and two mates I've known my whole life, and we just get drunk for five hours, put the whole thing out. It's a mess, but it's always good fun. We've done it every year as the end of year thing. And I always make notes of things to talk about. And literally just before I walked in here, the note I added was, who writes bad reviews? Because that's, again, it's the epitome of pettiness. It's such a mad thing to go... And whether it be on a restaurant or on a podcast, I'd listen to another podcaster who'd got a bad review and was going through it. Just who would take the time to go, you know what, I want to let them know, that human know that I think they're shit.
Isn't that crazy?
Why?
I always keep
it,
like,
it's okay to think it.
Yeah.
You don't have to like everyone or everything, but why do you feel the need to let them know?
You know, look, I think critical narrative is important, or critical responses to things. It's like, but my way of doing it would be to say, you know, and it's a little cushy too, but sort of like lead with the positive, you know, find merit in something. Or if you're going to say you don't like something, don't get the knives out. You know, this is my problem, is like filmmakers, authors, painters, musicians, anyone who's putting their work out to be judged is a human being that put a lot of care and tried to do something and tried to employ people. And whatever their intention is, they didn't just like do it like clicking their fingers. It took work. Then to presume that you come along and watch it and go, I'm going to use this as a creative writing exercise in humiliation. And sometimes I get this feeling like reviewers are all waiting in the shadows and they all look at each other and they go, is this one of those ones? Do we all get to fucking like stab this guy in the kidneys? And they all flex their creative writing muscles, and I can't help but sit back and go, okay, that was a clever thing you just did, right? You know, smiley star for you for being so pithy and ironic and clever and witty and blah, blah, blah. But go walk in that person's shoes. Have you ever tried to make a movie? Have you ever tried to paint a picture or write a book or write music and release it? Like, don't be vicious, because you hurt someone. You really hurt them. And smarter people, and I consider myself, you know, slightly smart, are going to look down on you for being cruel.
Yeah.
Because you're essentially a gossip with a typewriter.
Yeah.
You know, you're a little town gossip. Yeah. You're like, look how smart I am. I remember someone writing a review about a movie saying, 10 things I would rather do than watch this movie again. And they were things like pull my fingernails off and, you know, fill my mouth with spiders and staple my lips shut and all that. And I was like, okay, that was clever, but it was cruel.
Yeah.
So fuck you.
Yeah.
You know?
Completely agree. Well, I mean, I'll start to wrap things up now. But before we do, I do want to talk a bit about Underground Railroad, because I thought it was absolutely astounding. I think Barry is astounding. I wonder, I feel I didn't hear enough people talking about it, and I think we were at a point of exhaustion socially with all the Black Lives Matter stuff that happened during the pandemic, with the pandemic itself. But it felt like a really important show to me, and it's a period piece, but it's obviously reflecting on modern times as well, whether that be things going on in America. Obviously, like the recent voice referendum in Australia was heartbreaking to see. I know that's something that you showed your support to the right side, in my opinion, on how important, I guess, are these stories to make us reflect upon where we are in society now, where we should be in society in the future, how far we haven't come or how far we have come?
It's a really good question. I suspect that a lot of people didn't really get through all of Underground Railroad. And I can understand why, if there's like, because, you know, on one hand, you could argue that the way to talk about subjects is to wrap them up in a different parcel, is to make them less confronting. And if you have a message or an opinion or whatever, is to wrap them up in a way that people get tricked almost into the cinema or under watching and go, oh, I didn't know I would know this about history. Or, you know, for example, I think Get Out was a movie that talked about race, but it was wrapped up in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And interestingly, and I want to talk about Underground Railroad because, you know, Boy Erased is an interesting example. We discovered that the challenge with like getting that film out into the world was all the people that agreed that two men should have a right to be in a relationship together or get married together or any of those things, that homosexuality wasn't a sin.
Yeah.
They were totally game and keen to see the film. Or knew they didn't need to see the film because they already agreed with the film.
Yeah.
The harder audience to get are the people that you want to see the film because you want the film to change minds. But they're the people who are like, ah, this, you know, liberal piece of junk, I'm not going to watch that. Like, why would I already hate you, you know? Why would I watch your film? So the challenge is, what form do you, or how do you dress up your story? Now, when it comes to Underground Railroad, there's no skirting around what Barry's done. Even though there's a magical realist element to the fabric of the book.
Yeah, the railroad
itself.
It's
also a document, like within the narrative. It's a record, and it was important for Barry that becomes an indelible record. For some people, they don't want to watch it. For some people, they're like, I know, and that's either too confronting for me because it's my ancestors and I can't take myself into that space. Or I already know that was the world that my ancestors went through, so I don't need to watch it. And all people that are, you know, have a different color skin who are like, I don't want to know that my ancestors were responsible for participating in that stuff. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of people that go confronted by the horrors and the violence.
Truth. I'm glad it was made, but I don't want to look at it.
Yeah. But then there are people that will really, really turn their attention to it, you know, and I'm certain Barry was aware that, you know, there are going to be a number of people who go, okay. And I knew people who watched the whole thing, but they were like, they watched an episode and then they needed a break.
I had a break every time. And normally I put it on to binge it and then I was like, this is going to take a few weeks, you know, because it was exactly that. It's a lot. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful, and I knew people who watched the whole thing, but they took like a week just to like absorb each episode.
Yeah.
But I think what he did is remarkable, and I think he got some of the best out of me that I've ever been able to provide somebody, and I went into there with a real fearful excitement of going, how do I do this? How do I lean into this? You know, and I had an incredible time with him.
I love it. Well, I'm going to wrap things up there because I want you to find out how the Peppa Pig experience has been for your family whilst in London. I don't want you have to hold off on that excitement any longer.
So. Big. It's funny, I recently went to the Marrakesh Film Festival, was on the jury,
yeah,
which was I actively chose to do, A, because I was, you know, flattered that they would ask me, but I was like, after a year of, you know, being through strikes, both as a writer and as an actor, I was like, yeah. I need some inspiration from younger filmmakers, like see what people are talking about, how they're making films. And I was so glad I did it. But I watched 14 films in 7 days,
wow.
all subtitled, real brain exhaustion, but
yeah.
like so happy I did it. But I realized like I saw more movies in that 7 days than I'd seen almost all year.
Yeah,
I've seen been in the cinema 3 times because of, you know, kids. I blame my kids. It's your fault. But I've seen every episode of Peppa Pig numerous times and Miffy, and I'm just wondering how these things are going to influence my next film.
Yeah. I love it. I love the
Bluey is the best.
The mixture of Peppa Pig, Bluey, and 14 subtitled films into the American film Turkish films.
About is an Islamic, you know, school, you know, film in Morocco evoking hidden stories about the bread riots and, you know, like all this stuff. And then Peppa Pig. I mean, the drama in George's dragon balloon, like floating up in the sky and getting rescued by a parrot. Heavy.
People thought they're getting Greta Gerwig to do a Barbie movie was mind-blowing. I can't wait for what's next from you, bringing together the worlds of Peppa Pig and Bluey. And
that's a message to the audience out there. Hold on to your pink outfits that you wore to the Barbie premiere, because you're going to need them for my real-world Peppa Pig movie. I'm going to be Daddy Pig.
It's going to be the Barbenheimer thing, but in one movie. It's not these two separate darkness and light. Let's bring them together.
I'm going to shoot Peppa Pig the movie, and I'm going to wait for Christopher Nolan to make his next film. Yeah. And I'm going to make sure that the titles fit together, and I'm going to capitalise on it. Wasn't that the most extraordinary thing?
All you need is a subheading and you'll make it match up. Yeah, that was the crazy thing.
Literally, I was staying in Hampstead and at the Everyman Cinema, where it normally has the titles of 3 movies, it just said, for 3 weeks, it just said Barbenheimer.
Yeah. The madness. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. It's been a pleasure to catch up. I look forward to seeing you again in another 5 years.
Let's make
on this date.
Let's make it 3.
All right, let's
we'll
do
go
it.
5, 3, 1, yeah, and then
we'll
I'll
break it
be...
down. You'll just be a co-host. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Joel Edgerton. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And honestly, go and see The Boys in the Boat. It blew me away. It's a nightmare, right? I did my Films of the Year podcast last week. Prior to this year starting, I'd seen 4 films and 3 of them I already think are going to be in the running for my Films of the Year at the end of this year. And one of them is The Boys in the Boat. I'll be back next week with another wonderful guest. Do you want to know who it is? It's only bloody Samuel T. Herring from Future Islands. What a mad one. It's mad because one of his performances was one of the ones I showed on the thing on Pip and B show each other stuff over on my Twitch channel. So yeah, it's a hell of a conversation. He's a hell of a dude. He gave me loads of time as well. So we're really kicking the year off with some meaty episodes. So enjoy the substance, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back next week with that. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.